All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world. Happy Wednesday, everybody. Today is March 11th, 2026. And our top story this morning, private credit is back in the news. We've got another one. This time it's Cliffwater. It's a $33 billion private credit fund is seeing redemptions surge. People want their money back, and some of them are probably not going to get it. At least not yet. They're going to have to wait. Redemptions at this Cliffwater private credit fund have surged, I'm quoting the article here, in excess of 7%. Now, in excess of 7% could be anything from 7.01 all the way up to 100%. We don't know how much. It's probably not 100%. All we know is that it is in excess of 7. And that 7% threshold is very important for this fund because Cliffwater is obligated to redeem up to 5% every quarter. So we know they're going to redeem 5% of the shares, and they have the discretion to redeem up to 7%. They may or they may not do that extra 2%, but all people above 7% who are requesting redemption, and all we know is that is in excess of that, we don't know how much, they're not going to get their money back. They're going to have to wait. So what we've got here is we've got another big private credit fund, $33 billion. This is not a small fund. They're going to be gating withdrawals again. They're going to be telling people who want their money back, no. BlackRock, Blackstone, all these other firms, they're all doing it. I've been warning about this for well over a year now, that this private credit industry is rife with bad debt, lacks underwriting standards, and it looks like the Tricolor, the First Brands, the Carioc Capitals, the Market Financial Solutions, all of Jamie Dimon's cockroaches have spooked enough people, combined with this worry about software apocalypse or whatever the heck the AI bros are screaming about on any given day. Combine all these things, and retail investors who are typically very flighty are spooked, and they want to get their money out. And this is exposing a vulnerability that has always been there in private credit. And that's an important thing. It was never a matter of if this was going to happen. It was always a matter of when, because by their very nature, private credit loans are illiquid, hard to sell at any given time, very hard to mark accurately, which none of them have done, which means this gating of withdrawals was always going to happen. It's just, it's happening all at once. And every time it happens, it spooks more investors. And then more people want their money back. And then more withdrawals get gated. And guys, this is how a fire sale happens, a stampede for the exits. And all of these funds have these safeties built into them where they would gate redemptions, basically tell people, no, you can't have your money back. So they're not forced to sell assets at fire sale prices, which they would otherwise have to do. So we've got Cliffwater is now added to the ranks of funds that will be gating redemptions. And then we've got JP Morgan is also in the news in private credit this morning. They're marking down loans on private credit. We don't know how much. There was shockingly and suspiciously very little numbers in this article about JP Morgan writing down loan values. But JP Morgan saying, we looked at the marks here. These loans are obviously not worth what we were carrying them on our books for. And because they're writing down these loans, which are, of course, mostly to software companies, they're restricting further lending into private credit, which means they're going to stop making these loans to the private credit firms so the private credit firms can take that money and just loan it off to these companies. So, guys, this is a liquidity crisis in the private credit space now, and I don't think that is doomerism. I don't think that's excessive language. It is absolutely a liquidity crisis. All of these gating controls are being used. The banks are on defense. And keep in mind, JP Morgan, this is a company that has loaned tens of billions of dollars to private credit firms, even as their CEO was out in the press talking about cockroaches and how irresponsible the industry was. Maybe a little bit of self-awareness is in order for America's biggest bank. Now, other news going on this morning, we got CPI. Normally, CPI is a pretty big story. It's a big deal on this channel. Today, it's kind of not. Headline CPI for February, mind you, 2.4% year over year, unchanged and in line with expectations. So inflation went a whole bunch of nowhere in February. I wouldn't get too comfortable with that, with energy prices doing what they're doing, tariffs finally starting to hit. Something tells me we're going to be looking at higher CPI in the future. But for now, it's a no, never mind. And the other thing to keep in mind, guys, CPI has been highly, highly questionable for years, but particularly since the end of the government shutdown, where CPI has relied heavily on imputations, which means we just kind of guess. We don't actually measure prices. In particular, we have now had two consecutive months of negative month-over-month price changes in electricity, according to CPI. Not according to freaking anybody's electric bill. No, just according to CPI. And it's one reason why these numbers are increasingly worthless. Now, we've got a lot of updates out of the Middle East, as expected. That is a big story. It's a series of stories that are popping up all over the world. Oil, as of the hitting go live button, was about $87 a barrel. So it's down a little bit this morning. Why would oil be down? Well, the IEA, or the International Energy Administration, they are preparing, or they're asking for one of the biggest releases of petroleum reserves in history, up to 400 million barrels dumped from the member petroleum reserves. Now, we've seen this for 3 days in a row now, this jawboning about dumping the SPR. All right, we saw the G7 did it, then they did it again. They never, or at least they were talking about doing it. They didn't do it. Then a day later, on Tuesday, they were talking about it again. They didn't do it. And this morning, it's the IEA. They're talking about doing it. Now, here's the difference. Yes, they're still jawboning. They're still talking. But some countries are not waiting for an international agreement. Germany and Japan have both stepped up and announced that they will be dumping from their petroleum reserves. They're not waiting for the G7 ministers to get together and talk about how much from everybody. So clearly, Germany and Japan may be feeling the pain a little bit more. Japan's not too surprising. And Europe, the energy policy in that continent has been just utterly insane for decades now. So that's not terribly surprising either. Now, as that is all going on, we had three ships were confirmed hit in the Strait of Hormuz last night. Those were cargo ships, not oil tankers. We have been theorizing that some ships were flipping off their transponders and just trying to run the gauntlet. Why? Because they're effing insane, I guess. Three of them got hit last night. Now, Iran is also believed to be mining the Strait of Hormuz. Stories broke yesterday that the Iranians were laying these mines. We've got a story this morning that the U.S. claims they destroyed 16 mine-laying vessels. The Iranians are using smaller, faster mine layers that can only lay two or three mines apiece, according to these articles. And it looks like we've begun to target those ships. So that's another problem that's largely expected. And, well, luckily, the United States minesweepers are older than dirt and nowhere near the Middle East right now. So that's going to be fun. And the littoral combat ship, the most expensive boondoggle in military history, was supposed to fill the role of minesweeper, but they actually never got that to work because despite all the buzzwords about modularity, the littoral combat ship is basically a piece of crap. All right. Also going on this morning, fertilizer prices are going up. They're talking about corn again. 2022 called and they want their headlines back. That one's coming back. We've got Greece is implementing profit caps. That's right. Profit caps. Price controls. Oh, excuse me. Price control. Yeah. For a minute there, it sounded like price controls. Weird. Not a price control. We're calling it a profit gap. It's a totally different thing. We've got MSC, the shipping giants. They are putting emergency fuel surcharges on all cargo going pretty much anywhere. It's getting more expensive to ship. It's going to get more expensive to buy. So you can count on those inflation numbers going higher because of this conflict. We've got a story about Binance. This is interesting this morning. The Department of Justice is probing the use of Binance by Iran to evade sanctions and launder money for terrorists. Boy, am I glad we pardoned that a-hole. Note sarcasm. What else we got? Oh, the United States. We are building a refinery in this country. Somebody pinch me. Am I dreaming? For the first time in 50 freaking years, the United States is going to build a new oil refinery thanks to an investment from India's Reliance Industries. It's going to be specialized in refining the oil that we actually pump out of the ground here, the light sweet crude. Wow, an American refinery that refines American oil. Call me crazy. Like, what the hell took so long? But hey, we're doing it. We've also got 50,000 layoffs announced at Volkswagen. That was late yesterday. Now, Volkswagen reported earnings yesterday. We talked about it on this channel. They were gross, down more than 50% year over year. 50,000 people going to lose their job between now and 2030 as a result of that. Chinese electric vehicles, tariffs, runaway energy stupidity, pick your poison. They're all affecting the European auto industry. And we've got China's shipping giant Costco has announced that they will be effective immediately shutting down operations at the Panama Canal. The Chinese are pissed that under pressure from President Trump, Panama basically kicked them out of the canal, canceled their contract, and handed over to Maersk. And, well, screw them if they can't take a joke. Guys, we got a lot to talk about today. We're going to go pretty fast through some of these stories because I want to touch on each and every one of them. So bear with me here. And hey, while we're at it, don't forget that like button. Don't forget that subscribe button also. And I must remind you that today is the day George Noble's Best Stock Ideas Summit, where yours truly will be presenting. I will be going in just a few hours here at noon will be my turn. So click on the link down in the description there. There is still time to get your tickets. And right now, the S&P 500 is lower by 8 points or 0.12% to the downside. Not a very big move in the S&P here. The Dow is off by 129 points or about a quarter of a percent. We'll see if this is going to turn out to be one of those open red, buy the dip at lunch, close flat on the day kind of trading sessions. And the NASDAQ is pretty much unchanged here, down 4 points, 3 points, 0.01%. Stock's not doing a lot this morning. The U.S. dollar is stronger here by 20 basis points at 99.13. Looks like we had a nice step change here on that CPI release. The unchanged inflation caused a little bit of strengthening in the dollar. Maybe some people are a little less enthusiastic about the possibility of further rate cuts from the Federal Reserve. I couldn't tell you, but either way, dollar a little bit stronger this morning. Looking over at the bond market, we've got yields are moving higher on the long end of the curve. The 30-year Treasury is at 4.827. That's up by 5.5 basis points this morning. The 10-year Treasury is at 4.184, higher by almost 4 points. The 2-year is at 3.619, 5 points higher as well. And even the 1 month is a little bit higher at 3.70, higher by a fraction of a point. Let's look over at Bitcoin this morning. We are at $69,900, pretty much unchanged from where we were yesterday, hovering just below $70,000. And we've got this one broke just moments ago in the Wall Street Journal. The Justice Department probes Iran's use of Binance to evade sanctions. Oops, investigation focuses on money flowing through crypto platform to network backing terror groups, including Yemen's Houthi militants. The Justice Department is investigating Iran's use of Binance to evade U.S. sanctions. The probe follows the crypto exchange's dismantling of an internal investigation into more than $1 billion that flowed through the platform to a network funding Iran-backed terror groups, according to company documents and people familiar with the matter. The crypto platform was investigating this Iranian money laundering thing. They stopped the investigation, and the Department of Justice said, no problem, we'll take it from here. Officials have contacted people with knowledge of the Iranian transactions to seek interviews and gather evidence, some of the people said. The Wall Street Journal couldn't determine whether the Justice Department is investigating Binance itself for potential misconduct or solely the customers on its platform. The inquiry puts the world's largest crypto exchange back in the legal spotlight after its founder, Changpeng Zhou, known as CZ, received a pardon from President Trump in October. Oh, that pardon is going to age like milk, isn't it? Boy, am I glad we pardoned that asshole. Binance pleaded guilty in 2023 to violating U.S. anti-money laundering and sanctions laws, paying a $4.3 billion fine and agreeing to operate under U.S. oversight. Joe pleaded guilty to a related charge and spent 4 months in jail. All right, 4 months for laundering money for terrorists. That's not bad. And you might be surprised to learn that after getting convicted but then pardoned, a money launderer decides he's going to go ahead and launder money again. Amazing how that works. Taking a look at the commodities board this morning, we've got gold is down modestly, $5,179 for spot gold. That's off by about 14 bucks or a quarter of a percent. April COMEX gold futures are at 51.85, down by about 55 bucks or 1% lower. Spot silver is at 85.70, $2.50 lower or about 2.9% in the red. May COMEX silver futures are down $3.73 to $85.86, off by about 4.1%. Again, still a little bit volatile here, mid-80s, down a couple of bucks, but nowhere near what we saw last month. I like the shiny still. We've got copper is lower by 1.6%, platinum lower by 2%, palladium lower by 2.8%, 2.75%, give or take. Oil is a little bit higher this morning. WTI crude is at $86 and change, up by $2.60, or about 3.1% higher. May Brent crude is at $90.75. That's higher by almost $3 or 3.3%. We'll look at those oil charts in just a minute. Natural gas is up by about 3%, and RBOB gasoline futures are higher by 4.75% this morning. But first, let's talk about the bigger ones. The big story here, the private credit. Cliffwater's $33 billion private credit fund to see 7% plus redemptions. And again, the big takeaway here and the question I have is how much above 7%, right? 15 is above 7, but so is 8. And there's a big difference. They're not telling us that. Cliffwater LLC is facing redemption requests in excess of 7% from its flagship private credit fund, according to people with knowledge of the matter. The $33 billion Cliffwater Corporate Lending Fund is structured as an interval fund, requiring it to repurchase up to 5% of its shares each quarter if investor requests meet that threshold, which they certainly did. If redemptions exceed 5%, Cliffwater has discretion to repurchase as much as 7% of outstanding shares. All right, so they could go up to 7, or they could slam the door shut at 5. All we know is the requests are greater than 7, which means at least somebody at the end of the line is not going to get their money back this quarter. Founded by Stephen Nesbitt, Cliffwater is the latest firm in the $1.8 trillion private credit market to see an investor exodus over concerns about loan quality and exposure to software companies that could be disrupted by advancements in AI. The fund's tender window is set to close on Tuesday, and the firm hasn't yet decided whether to limit redemptions at the 5% or 7% mark, said the people who asked not to be identified, of course, naming private things. The article goes on to list all the other funds, Blackstone, BlackRock, all these private credit funds that have gated shares, gated redemptions recently. You can add Cliffwater to that list here. And JP Morgan is in the news in the private credit space this morning as well. JPM restricts private credit lending after loan markdowns. This article is suspiciously light on the details. I don't know why that is, but I couldn't help but notice JP Morgan is restricting some lending to private credit funds after marking down the value of certain loans in their portfolio. That's according to a person familiar with the matter, in the latest sign of stress in the $1.8 trillion industry. The devalued loans are to software companies, the person added, some of the biggest borrowers fueling the growth of the private credit market. Software has been in the spotlight in recent weeks due to investor concerns over the impact of AI. The decision was reported earlier by the Financial Times. Wall Street lenders like JP Morgan act as banks to private credit funds, providing them with the cash using their loans as collateral. A reduction in the value of those assets will curtail the amount of the bank is able to lend to these funds, heaping further pressure on an industry already grappling with a succession of hefty withdrawals from retail investors, spooked by renewed scrutiny of underwriting standards and developments in AI. Wall Street banks have been the staunchest financial supporters of the private credit industry, lending about $300 billion to credit funds as of late June. That's according to Moody's ratings report from October, based on data from the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. JP Morgan had $22.2 billion of exposure to private credit, the report showed. I have seen estimates that place that number as high as $50 billion worth of loans by JP Morgan to the private credit industry. The actual number is probably somewhere in between there. Biggest bank has taken losses here. We don't know how big. They're not telling us how much they're marking down those loans by, how much total, what's the percentage markdown, how much total losses. All they say is they're marking them down, and because they're marking them down, they're lending less. Look for more details on this one in the days ahead. All right. Meanwhile, let's talk about inflation, or I guess let's talk about how inflation really didn't matter today. U.S. headline CPI, 2.4%, flat versus January at 2.4%, down slightly from the 2.7% that we saw in November and December. And of course, October, the government shutdown. Isn't it just amazing? I just have to point out the coincidence that inflation was trending higher and then the government shuts down. They lay off a bunch of people at the BLS. They start guessing more. instead of actually measuring, and all of a sudden inflation starts moving lower. I'm beginning to think these two things may be related. Call me crazy. On a month-over-month rate, the inflation rate came in at 0.3%. That is in line with expectations, up a tick from January, but not that much. Core inflation, again, highly suspicious curve here, came in at 2.5%. This is when you strip out food and energy. In line with expectations and unchanged from a month ago. All right, now let's talk about what's going on in the Middle East and in energy markets. It's the biggest story in the world for at least the next couple of weeks here. WTI crude at $86. The important thing here, guys, you can see the price. Yes, we've had some swings up and swings down, but in the last 2 days, the price really hasn't budged all that much here, kind of settling into the high 80s. Even though the headline risk hasn't really gone away, the war doesn't seem to be slowing down all that much. There are conflicting reports about the number of Iranian attacks are slowing down, maybe fewer missiles, but bigger ones, but the drones are still being hit or still flying, still reports of ships getting hit. We're going to talk about those in a second, but it's been unable to really spook energy markets, at least for the last day or two. Monday, the energy market was nuts. The energy market was really spooked on Monday, and maybe that brutal sell-off has made people a little hesitant to pile long into the oil markets, understandably so. Anybody who piled in long on Monday morning got absolutely destroyed in that trade. But let's talk about what's going on here this morning. The IEA proposes a massive release of emergency oil stockpiles. All right, this is the same release, the 400 million barrels that the G7 was saying we may go as high as 400 million barrels on Monday. They didn't do it. Tuesday, they said it again. Today, it's the IEA that's saying it. All right, there's still no international agreement on how much of this oil they're going to dump from their reserves. All right, so obviously some countries probably want the U.S. to dump more. Hey, you started it. You dump your oil reserve. And then we're like, no, it's going to be your oil. We're not going to dump the American oil. It's going to be your oil. And China's going to pay for it. Probably something like that going on. Anyways, while that international bickering is happening, some countries are not waiting. Japan will unilaterally release oil from their reserves, the prime minister says. Japan is talking about a release that would begin as soon as March 16th. That is next Monday. That's according to Prime Minister Takaichi. The equivalent of 15 days of Japan's oil consumption will be released from the private sector stocks and 1 month worth of national reserves. Japan is not waiting. Also, Germany is not waiting. Germany to release oil reserves after the IEA request, the minister says. And again, they're not sitting around and not waiting for the G7 to come to some agreement. They're just going to go ahead and do it. Germany will release part of its oil reserves after the IEA recommended the release of 400 million barrels of oil from stockpiles, the largest such move in IEA history, Germany's economy minister Katarina Rich said on Wednesday. Scant details here. I don't see anything in this article about the number of barrels or the number of days of supply that Germany is releasing, but we have got two countries will be releasing oil from their reserves while the rest of the world debates it. That's going on. Meanwhile, we've got ships continue to be hit. Three ships hit by projectiles in the Middle East, the UK Navy says. This just this morning, the UK Navy said three vessels were hit with suspected projectiles in the Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf on Wednesday as the conflict in the region continues to menace shipping. The targets, none of which were identified, include a cargo ship in the Strait of Hormuz off Oman, a container vessel west of Ras Al Khaimah, and a bulk carrier northwest of Dubai. That's according to the UK Maritime Trade Operations Center, or the UKMTO. A fire aboard the cargo ship has been extinguished, and there's no environmental impact at this time, it said. The skeleton crew remains on board. No words about casualties on any of these ships, but it's a good bet there are some. Three boats hit overnight. Even as if we've got story about Iran signaling it may deploy mines to disrupt the Strait of Hormuz. This broke late yesterday, and I'm pretty sure it's not signaling. I'm pretty sure they're actually doing it. Iran may be getting ready to deploy naval mines in the Strait of Hormuz in an effort to further disrupt the key shipping lane, U.S. officials told CBS News. The American officials said Iran is using smaller craft that can carry 2 to 3 mines each to lay them into the strait. While Iran's mine stock isn't publicly known, estimates over the years have ranged from roughly 2,000 to 6,000 naval mines, largely produced by Iran, China, or Russia. The official spoke to CBS News on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly. And we've got other stories breaking this morning that say the U.S. has destroyed, I think it was 10 to 16 small mine-laying vessels. They said they were inactive in that article. I question that inactive part. So we've got rumors that they might be mining the strait. We've got several ships getting hit by unknown projectiles. Mine isn't really a projectile, but that could be just miswording in the articles. And then we've got reports of the U.S. blowing up mine-laying boats. It's a good bet there's mines in the strait here now, guys. And even as everybody has been focusing on oil and natural gas, keep an eye on food prices, guys. This is a very 2022 kind of headline here. Prolonged Iran war could shrink U.S. corn acres, analysts say. And I remember I made a lot of videos about this the last time fertilizer prices went higher. I actually did all right on this trade. Corn prices went sharply higher, as did most agricultural commodities in 2022 following the Russian invasion here. But Reuters is reporting that the world's farmers face soaring fertilizer and fuel prices as war in the Middle East escalates, leaving some scrambling for supplies as the spring planting season approaches. Prices in the U.S., which imports much of its fertilizer needs despite a large domestic industry, rose at the war's outbreak. Prices for fertilizer jumped from $516 per metric ton last Friday to $683 at the import hub of New Orleans on Thursday. Prices could jump higher if the Persian Gulf closure persists and shipments can't make it in time for the spring planting season, analysts told Reuters. Literally, this could not happen at a worse time of year, said StoneX analyst Josh Linville. By the way, guys, this story is a few days old, March 9th. So this was released 2 days ago. So they're talking about this jump in fertilizer prices that happened late last week. It has almost certainly gone higher since. Seth Meyer, former U.S. Department of Agriculture chief economist and now the Food and Agriculture Policy Research Institute, said farmers might alter crop choices and fertilizer applications due to the price spike. Thuckrell and White reported, farmers need fertilizers for virtually all of their crops if they want a good yield, but each crop and the soil they are grown in have different demands. Farmers could cut back on corn, which requires a high rate of nitrogen fertilizer, or else sharply reduce fertilizer application rates. Of course, if they reduce fertilizer application, the yield will likely drop. So this could affect your agriculture commodities. It might be a little early to be, you know, banging the drum on corn prices just yet, but this is worth keeping an eye on. Meanwhile, Greece is going to impose a cap on profit margins for fuel and groceries. And what is price controls by any other name? Is it not still a price control? Yeah. Oh, it sounds a lot better. It pulls much better in focus groups when we say we're going to limit the profits of those greedy corporations, those greedy grocery stores, and those greedy gas station owners. Are we back to that BS, by the way? Are we blaming gas station owners again? Apparently, that's a thing. This is price controls. And let's not put it past our supposedly conservative president here in the United States to try something similar. Could very well see this spreading here. Greece is the first to do it. All right. Also going on this morning, we've got shipper MSC introduces emergency fuel surcharges. This one broke a few days ago, but this story is expanding further today. Shipping company MSC on Monday announced emergency fuel surcharges on all cargo from the Mediterranean and the Black Sea to the Indian subcontinent, Red Sea, and East Africa. The move includes the West Mediterranean, Adriatic, East Mediterranean, Greece, and Turkey, and applies from March 16th until March 31st. All right, so one of the things we've heard a lot about is that bunkering fuel is getting hard to come by. Bunkering fuel is basically fuel for ships. And one of the places a lot of these ships tend to fill up is in the Middle East. Well, that's not working out so well here. And with disruptions from the Strait of Hormuz, they're worried about future bunkering oil supplies. So they're making it more expensive to ship cargo. And then the story just broke today. There's no headlines, but it scrolled across the Bloomberg terminals a few minutes ago that MSC is now putting fuel surcharges on cargo from Asia to the Western Hemisphere as well, in particular China to the U.S. So these fuel surcharges, they're basically going to affect everybody. It's going to get more expensive to move things. And if things are more expensive to move, they're going to be more expensive to buy off the shelf. That's why don't get too comfy with that 2.4% inflation print, guys. It's just not going to last. I don't care how much you impute the data, it's still going to affect you. And we've got this one. This is honestly the first like really good news I've seen in a while. I don't know what took it so long, but we're finally doing it. Trump says the U.S. will build the first refinery in 50 years with investment from India's Reliance Industries. It has been 5 decades since we built an oil refinery in this country. That is insulting. President Donald Trump announced Tuesday that the U.S. will get its first oil refinery in 50 years, funded by investments from Indian billionaire Mukesh Ambani's Reliance Industries. He does a whole bunch of stuff in all caps and True Social. Reliance owns the world's largest oil refinery in Jamnagar, India, and has a market capitalization of $206 billion, according to LSEG data. The new refinery will be located in the port of Brownsville, Texas, and it will strengthen our national security, boost American energy production, deliver billions of dollars in economic impact, and will be the cleanest refinery in the world, Trump said. The refinery is designed to process 100% American shale oil and is being developed by America First Refining. Now, that's important, guys, because we have not built a refinery in this country for 50 years, as I said. And the refineries that we do have in this country are all built to refine Middle Eastern oil, not the oil that we are now the largest producer in the world of that comes out of shale. So we have a mismatch between our refining capacity and the type of oil we make. So this makes sense that we're actually building an American refinery to refine American oil. What a freaking concept. What has taken so long? I don't know, but at least they're doing it. America First Refining said in a statement Tuesday that it received a 9-figure investment from a global supermajor at a 10-figure valuation without giving any further details about the investors. The same global supermajor has also signed a 20-year deal to purchase, process, and distribute shale oil sourced and produced stateside, America First Refining added. The refinery will process 1.2 billion barrels of U.S. light shale oil valued at $125 billion and produce 50 billion gallons of refined products worth $175 billion. I don't know where those numbers came from. Is this like over the life of the plant, 1.2 billion barrels of oil? That's 10 days worth of global oil supplies. So maybe this is like an annual number. I don't know where they're getting these numbers from, but it's going to be a big refinery and it's going to process American oil. It's about time. Also, yesterday we got an announcement from Volkswagen. Shout out to my friends at MacroEdge who found this one. Volkswagen layoffs. German auto giant targets 50,000 job cuts amid rising EV competition. Yikes, a lot of people losing their job in Europe here. Volkswagen has announced plans to reduce its workforce in Germany by around 50,000 jobs by 2030 as the company grapples with mounting financial and competitive pressures. The decision comes after the carmaker reported profits at their lowest level in almost a decade, reflecting the challenges facing the global auto industry, in particular energy supply, tariffs, and Chinese electric vehicles. In total, around 50,000 jobs are due to be cut by 2030 across the Volkswagen Group in Germany, CEO Oliver Blum said in a letter to shareholders. The planned reductions build on an earlier agreement reached with labor unions in late 2024. Under that deal, the company committed to eliminating around 35,000 roles within its core Volkswagen brand by the end of the decade as part of a broader effort to reduce costs. That initiative is expected to save the automaker roughly 15 billion euros annually. All right, so I guess that tempers this a little bit, or maybe it softens the blow. They're going to lay off 50,000 people, but they had already announced 35,000 of those layoffs, so it's a net addition of 15,000 jobs. I don't think that makes anybody feel any better, but at least it's not as awful news as the headline would suggest, an increase in planned layoffs at Volkswagen, a pretty substantial one, as the European auto industry is in trouble, as is the auto industry anywhere in the world. This is a tough time to be a car maker. And meanwhile, we've got that other vitally important waterway that we're fighting over, or at least we're not killing each other over. We're just fighting on paper over it. The Panama Canal. That's a thing. China's COSCO halts Panama port operations as tensions rise. China's COSCO Shipping suspended its services at Panama's Balboa port, a local media report said, after Beijing warned of a heavy price for the Central American country's forced takeover of the facility from Hong Kong conglomerate CK Hutchison Holdings. The state-owned shipping giant announced its decision to halt all of its departures and arrivals at the port in a notice to customers dated on March 10th, That's according to a report in La Prensa. While all confirmed bookings will be canceled, cargo that has already arrived will be processed as normal, the outlet said. China previously asked its shipping companies to consider rerouting cargo through ports outside of Panama if it didn't result in a significant extra cost. That's what Bloomberg reported in February. Beijing also instructed state firms to halt talks over new projects in the country. The Balboa port is one of two terminals along the strategic Panama Canal that have become a flashpoint in the intensifying rivalry between the U.S. and China in Latin America. Panama's top court voided C.K. Hutchinson's contract to operate those two facilities in January amid pressure from President Donald Trump, followed by a forced takeover last month. You know, it's funny. Panama watched President Maduro be pretty much yanked out of bed in his pajamas by special forces. And then a couple of days later, they said, you know what? Upon further introspection, we are kicking China out of the Panama Canal. You think maybe those two might have been related? Just maybe. Those facilities are part of the 43-port global portfolio that C.K. Hutchinson, founded by billionaire Li Ka-shing, had planned to sell to a consortium backed by BlackRock for more than $19 billion in cash. That, of course, was last year, and the Chinese government put the kibosh on that $19 billion sale. Instead, they're going to get nothing, and they're just going to get kicked out anyway, so that's fun. The U.S. investment firm's involvement angered China, which threatened to launch investigations into the deal. First announced last March, C.K. Hutchinson last year invited Costco to join the buyer's group in a bid to win Beijing's approval. They weren't keen on that. For now, Panama has handed interim operations of the Balboa and Cristobal terminals to APM Terminals, a division of A.P. Moller Maersk. An Italian billionaire, oh man, I can't pronounce that, Gianluigi's Aponte's MSC Mediterranean Shipping Co., MSC's unit Terminal Investments, is also part of the buyer consortium. It's unlikely that Costco's latest move will significantly affect operations at the Balboa port, which relies on Maersk for about 80% of its cargo, La Prensa reported. So China's throwing a fit. The U.S., a firm led by BlackRock or a group led by BlackRock, was going to buy these ports from C.K. Hutchinson. C.K. Hutchinson had agreed to a price. The Chinese government said, no, we don't want you to do that. Then the United States went and grabbed Maduro out of his bed in the middle of the night. And all of a sudden, the Panamanians said, you know what, China, you're not allowed to do this anyway. So we're going to take those ports from you. We're going to give them to A.P. Moller Maersk, and you're going to get nothing instead of $19 billion. And the Chinese apparently are upset about that because they can't take a joke. A $19 billion punchline of a joke. But yeah, this was expensive. So I guess the lesson here is next time, just take the money because it's probably going to happen anyway. And look, guys, this is a commentary, this entire story about, you know, I hear a lot about international law and the rules-based order. Understand, guys, what the world is steaming toward in 2027. The whole concept of international law and the rules-based order is gone. It is dead. Might makes right until further notice. When we are resorting to our barbaric roots, as we have been doing since the beginning of this god-awful decade, there's no such thing as international law and rules-based order. So everybody's going to be throwing their weight around, muscling people in and out of deals, and we're going to see a lot more stories like this. It sucks, but it's what we are now. We're doing this, apparently. And I just want to say thank you very much to Jolly Lollipop, who says, what's the best way to trade oil? Is there an ETF? There are a number of oil ETFs. U.S. oil is the big one. I forget the ticker for U.S. oil. Just know that those ETFs had a lot of problems back in 2020 when prices went negative and they didn't really know what to do with them. A lot of people lost a lot of money in those. I don't think prices are going to go negative again. Just know that, you know, when you're messing around with ETFs, you never really own what you think you own. It's always the fine print that ends up costing people. The easiest way to trade oil, or another way to trade oil, names like ExxonMobil and Chevron, I mean, those are the cleanest ways to do it. They pay a decent dividend. I don't own either of those names. They're doing okay here. If you're really interested in trading oil from the Venezuela angle, Chevron is probably the better choice versus ExxonMobil. They're more likely to get contracts in Venezuela. They get the benefits and the risk that goes along with that. If you don't want anything to do with Venezuela, ExxonMobil is probably one of your better bets. Thank you, Jolly Lollipop, for supporting the channel, sir. Mr. 4Ps says, how do you decide when to buy the precious? Thanks. There's a lot of different things that I use to inform it. Number one, I look at the premiums. All right. I mean, I do look at the commodity price going up and down. I tend to look more closely when we get these price smashes, when the price drops dramatically. The only thing is when the price drops dramatically, you tend to see the premiums increase because people like me go and look at buying when the price drops dramatically. And so you never end up capturing as much of that decline. So it's really a judgment call based on a combination of what is the commodity doing? What are the premiums doing? What is the gold to silver ratio doing? So I don't really have any fixed formula. A lot of it, I just kind of go by feel. I can tell you, I have not bought any physical since $60 was the last that I bought. When it came to the physical, I saw what was going on in the paper markets. I saw all the bullshit with the AI guys about silver, and I didn't want anything to do with that noise. So I was trading a little bit in and out of call options and ETFs, and I did pretty well on those trades. But the last physical I bought was at 60. I may be looking to add here momentarily because I want to see the price settle in a little bit. And it looks like it's starting to settle here in the mid 80s. Thank you, Mr. 4P, for supporting the channel, sir. Jolly Lollipop is back again. Says Trump also commuted the sentence of Eli Weinstein, the fraud king of New Jersey. You know, I'm a New Jerseyan myself, and I am not familiar with that name. You'd think I would be. He got out and immediately went back in for more fraud crime. Are you suggesting that frauds, when they get away with it, do more fraud? Do I need to put on the tinfoil hat? Do we need to don the tinfoil hat to believe that? I am shocked that when you pardon frauds, they do more fraud. Look, guys, we need, I've said this before, we have got to start treating white collar crime more seriously in this country. White collar crime begets blue collar crime on a huge scale. When somebody embezzles millions of dollars, more money than people make in their entire lifetime, lives are destroyed, families fall apart, marriages fall apart. You get drunk driving deaths, you get liquor stores robbed, you get all kinds of drug overdose, all kinds of terrible things happen because of white collar crime and how unpunished it goes and the countless victims that it creates. And I don't know, I suspect I know why, because the people who make the laws and the people who enforce the laws are typically the ones doing the white collar crime. So I understand why they don't prosecute it. I just really wish they would. I really wish prosecutors would grow a pair and regulators would grow a pair already. But I guess things haven't gotten bad enough yet. Thank you, Jolly Lollipop, for supporting the channel. Hey, Real Estate Mindset says, happy birthday, Hunt and Cover. All right, happy birthday, Hunt and Cover. You know, this was going on in chat a few days ago. Everybody was wishing Hunt and Cover a happy birthday, and then he came in and said it wasn't really his birthday, but he did tell us when it was. Travis remembered. Thank you, Travis, you bonkers SOB. Everybody check out Real Estate Mindset on YouTube while you're at it. He's a good friend of the channel. Hunt and Cover says, thank you, Travis. You're not as cheap as Armando says you are. I love this. Thank you, guys. Thank you very much, Hunt and Cover, for the generosity. Happy birthday to you, sir. Thank you for everything you do for the channel as well. Jolly Lollipop back again says, if the world changed over to hydrogen fuel cell cars with the hydrogen produced from abundant coal, oil would not be so critical. I'm not crazy about that one, to be honest with you. Hydrogen fuel cells, I've been hearing a lot about this. And the other thing, you know, about hydrogen fuel cells, do you know how you get hydrogen from coal? You got to break the carbon-hydrogen bond. You know, the easiest way to break the carbon-hydrogen bond is to pull some oxygen out of the atmosphere, pair it up with the carbon. Oh, now you've got CO2, but you got your hydrogen fuel. And, you know, to do that, typically, yeah, it's an energy-positive reaction, but the refineries and everything that would actually generate that hydrogen, probably going to be pretty expensive. You still are going to need hydrocarbons as an input to get that hydrogen fuel. At the end of the day, you're not solving any environmental problems. You're just creating carbon dioxide through a different, more elaborate route. So I'm not crazy about hydrogen. Excuse me. I'm not crazy about hydrogen fuel cells. If you really want to decarbonize transport in particular, I think you need a lot of nuclear power for electricity. And I think you need a lot more electric vehicles, a lot more charging stations, and a lot better batteries that can charge faster and drive longer on them. Now, some of those technologies exist today. You know me, I'm very critical of electric vehicles because I think we went way too far too fast and the technology wasn't ready, something the automakers are paying the price for now. But long-term, if you really want to decarbonize and get off the oil, that's what you got to do. But that's only gasoline, guys. Remember, gasoline is only a big chunk of the oil that we use. We use a lot of oil to make plastic. We use a lot of oil to make fertilizer. Oil is used in everything. It's just not reasonable to think we could get off of oil anytime soon. So we're going to be fighting and dying over the black stuff for probably the rest of our lives. I'd love to think differently. I just don't see anything to support that this could ever actually happen. Thank you, Jolly Lollipop, for supporting the channel. EJ Walsh, what's going on? He says he traded an ounce of gold for 1,000 jars of peanut butter. Okay, what is the gold to peanut butter ratio telling us these days? That is a lot of calories there. Mind that expiration day, EJ Walsh. I'm not sure about the numbers behind that trade, but I like the shiny, and I also like peanut butter and jelly. Just throwing that out there. I'm a grown-ass man, but I love peanut butter and jelly. Thank you, EJ Walsh, for supporting the channel, sir. Ryu Kirito. I always struggle with that name, Ryu. I'm sorry. He says, why would the G7 have to agree on all released? Why can't a country just release its own oil reserve? They can. A country can release its own oil reserves. It's kind of like a matter of like, guys, we all have this problem. We all need to help solve it. Who is going to put themselves most at risk to solve it? All right. The last time the United States dumped most of the SPR, right? So we, through dumping our strategic petroleum reserve, we were subsidizing lower oil prices in other countries. And so if the U.S. were to dump all the SPR, nobody else would. They would all get the benefits while paying none of the cost. So the G7 agreement issue is like the countries are like, we need to agree on who's going to carry how much water. Everybody's going to chip in here. Germany and Japan said, we don't have time to wait. We're just going to go now. So Germany and Japan are already doing it. They're not sitting around and waiting. I would guess the United States is dragging their feet on dumping from the SPR right now. President Trump doesn't want gasoline prices to go sharply higher, especially heading into the midterms. It's bad for business. But at the same time, the United States is the biggest producer of oil in the world, and we're a net exporter of energy. So higher energy prices does hurt U.S. consumers, but it doesn't necessarily hurt the country, at least not as much as it used to hurt the country. All right. There are now some benefits that come along with that pain at the pump. So I suspect the U.S. is dragging their feet a little bit on the dumping of the SPR this time around. And it's also worth pointing out here that they want commitments from other countries, China, that they're not going to buy up this oil. In 2022, when we were weakening our own position, dumping oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in order to get oil prices down following the Russian invasion ahead of the midterms that time, you know what China did? China added to their reserves. So we dump all this oil on the market to bring the price down. The Chinese buy all that oil, bid the price right back up, and put that oil into their strategic stockpile. So all we really did was dump our reserves, weaken our country in order to enable cheap reserves for the Chinese. It was really, really stupid what we did in 2022, and we're not eager to repeat that mistake. So I suspect that's why the agreement hasn't happened yet. Thank you, Ryu, for supporting the channel. And thank you to the Beekeeper, who's been a Melonhead for 19 months, more than a year and a half. Thank you for supporting the channel, Beekeeper. He says, toasted bread with butter and PB&J is the bomb. I don't particularly toast my PB&J, but yeah, if you put it in front of me, I wouldn't say no. I like my old classic PB&J, you know, like in my Transformers lunchbox from second grade. Like, that's how I get down. I had a great childhood. What can I say? Thank you, Beekeeper, for the PB&J commentary, sir. And thank you, everybody, for having your coffee with the Melon Heads this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button on the way out. I will see you guys at noon for George Noble's Best Stock Ideas Summit, where I'll be presenting in just a few hours here. Thank you so much, everybody, for the super chats and the support of the channel, as well as you magnanimous Melon Heads on YouTube, Patreon, and Buy Me a Coffee. Links down below should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.